Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Two celebrated chefs are our guests tonight, Anthony Bourdain and Paul Kahn. Anthony Bourdain is known to everyone as the man who wrote Kitchen Confidential a few years ago, and Cook's Tour in Search of a Perfect Meal, which is also, of course, a television series. And Paul Kahn is the chef and the partner, the managing partner, at Blackbird, right on Randolph, here in Chicago. He's been crowned by the James Beard people, the James Beard Foundation, which named him the best chef in America Midwest region in 2004. And both of them are contributors to a new book titled Don't Try This at Home, subtitled Culinary Catastrophes from the World's Greatest Chefs. These are really war stories from about 20 or 30 American chefs, some of them, from elsewhere, but working in America, who've had catastrophes, as everybody does, who runs a restaurant. But I've got a special assignment for you gentlemen when we begin. As you may or may not know, in real life I am and have forever been a professor of psychology. Not clinical psychology, but still. There were a few researchers a number of years ago who opened up an interesting area of psychological research. The psychological or characterological dispositions which tended to go with success in different professions. Thus they found that successful surgeons tend to be on the sadistic side, but they've sublimated their sadism into creative and valuable work. They found that taxidermists who stuff animals tend to be schizophrenic or schizoid, but they found a proper sublimative approach. They found that clinical psychologists or psychiatrists tend to be lonely voyeurs who are living their lives, their dull lives, or activating or stirring them up through their observation of the more interesting, colorful, and crazy lives of their patients. You see what I'm leading to.
Oh, yeah.
What is the characterological disposition that tends to lead people into, not only into cooking publicly and professionally, but being good chefs? Paul Kahn.
For me, I think it's, I like to teach, and I like to see young people learn and grow, and that I think has been the secret to my success.
But those are good cover stories. Those are worthy.
I'm an egomaniac.
Motivations, but what? What's the secret pathology behind the career of a chef, Anthony Bourdain?
Listen, I think classically, chefs are Type A personalities, uh-huh. Control freaks, able to do many things at one, multitask. People who are not easily distracted by, and in fact, addicted mm-hmm. to. Multiple problems occurring at the same time and the solving of those
That's
problems.
That's running a vast kitchen.
Yeah, and even a small kitchen, there are 10 or 12 things you have to pay attention to. We tend to, literacy among chefs is not impressive stats. We tend to be oral and verbal, highly addictive personalities, sensualists, tactile.
Sensualist, that's interesting. Of course, food is a very sensual business in itself.
Well, I think it's our responsibility. As we're in the pleasure business, it is our responsibility as chefs, of course, to fully understand our subject of pleasure. So, for professional reasons, our appetites extend somewhat beyond food. I think that would be a common thread
among chefs. That explains something which showed up a lot in your first book, Kitchen Confidential, namely sexual adventures in the back room of the pantry on bags of potatoes and things like that.
I think, you know, just upholding a glorious tradition. You know, I travel a lot. I meet a lot of chefs from around the world. And again, I meet similar personality types. It's a very harsh business. So, you know, people who... It tends to weed out normal people through attrition very early.
How would you characterize the personality type that you meet as you talk to chefs around the world?
You know, pleasure-seeking sensualists who enjoy using all of their senses, mm-hmm. all the parts, both of not only their sense of taste and smell, but their ability as manipulators, managers, you know, to alter events around them to fit some kind of order. They like that mix between order and chaos.
Well, there you are, Paul. Anthony has given me a very good psychological portrait, whether correct or otherwise. Do you agree with him?
I agree for the most part. I think. I don't think that I fit that. I mean, type A personality, definitely crazy for details.
But you're not a sensualist.
I'm a sensualist, but I explore those things in other ways. I love music. I love the outdoors. Obviously, I love food. I think maybe mine is a little less X-rated, maybe because I was lucky enough to find the woman of my dreams a long time ago and have stuck with her. And, of course, my story in the book kind of relates to that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I would say I live kind of hard. I run around a lot. I like to have a few cocktails or four or five after work. And I like to see what's out there and talk with people, and just like most chefs. But I think the playing around aspect is something that haven't dived into at this point.
Okay, enough on that. Now, shift to something else. Now we look at this from a business point of view, or from a culture fads and culture variability, culture change point of view. Restaurants really keep changing. That is, the fads keep changing. I came to Chicago in 1965. At that time, of course, there wasn't a Thai restaurant in Chicago. There was barely a Mexican restaurant in Chicago. Mexican came first, and there were a lot of them suddenly popped up, and some of them are still there, and they're good. Thai came later. Various things came later. Just within the last half year, or within the last year, and Paul, you're surely aware of this, there's a kind of an epidemic of Brazilian steakhouses, or Brazilian, what do you call those places?
Churrascarias.
Yeah. There are four or five of them that have opened up right in hailing distance of this radio station.
Yeah. I think it's more a response to Americans' lust for different food and better
there
food.
There you are, yeah.
In the last 20 years, I mean, you know, Chicago, the capital of science food, which I don't want to get into that.
Science food?
Science food.
I'm not sure I know what that means.
There are several really well-renowned chefs in Chicago that are
doing their food on Bunsen burners.
Pretty much doing things.
Cooking over liquid nitrogen.
Yeah, I've heard about
doing
that.
Things
yeah.
with chemicals and things like that. But that's neither here nor there.
God defend me from such a restaurant. I wouldn't go to one.
Never say never. I said that before eating at El Bulli in Spain, and I.
Which is the one in Chicago that does that?
Well, there are three. There's Moto, Alinea. And a young man named Grant Elliott Bowles at the Peninsula Hotel, the restaurant there.
Uh-huh,
he does
really?
A little of the science food stuff, not as much as the other two
science
guys.
Science food.
Yeah, but I think it's Americans have really opened up to anything. I mean, you know, Charlie Trotter struggled the first 5 years that his restaurant was open in Chicago, and now it's embraced. It's full every night in, what is it, year 15, 18, 20, I don't know how long it's been open. And there are several of these temples to cuisine that people seek out, you know. So from there, they branch out to the little neighborhood places, to the ethnic places. To
Tony, in New York, are there still any good old-fashioned Jewish restaurants of the sort that used to flourish on Second Avenue?
Oh, Second Avenue Deli, you know, the Barney Greengrass up on 86th Street. Sure, there are.
So why are there none such in Chicago?
It's why are there none really in L.A.? Why can't anyone but us and maybe Montreal make a good bagel?
There's one in L.A., I forget its name, but it's right there on, what's the, you know, the main shopping street?
Yeah.
Beverly Hills.
Not as good as New York.
Rodeo Drive.
It's, you know, every city specializes in something. Thankfully, New York, you know, we're mm-hmm. famous for deli and we deserve the crown.
Yeah.
Why we haven't, it hasn't moved elsewhere, I don't know. It's just one of those inexplicable. You know, if you believe that food requires a certain kind of soul and context, as I like to think, you know, I think it's just in our blood that we have good Eastern European, you know, deli and Jewish cuisine.
It is funny how certain towns do very well with some cuisines, but sort of underrepresent or underperform with regard to other cuisines. There is a Chinatown in mm-hmm. Chicago, but I've got a son who's a big man in Seattle. And when we go to Seattle, there's a one in the so-called international district.
Right.
Every Chinese restaurant is superb. They're all better than anything I find on Wentworth.
Yeah, I think Chicago has the best Mexican food in America, certainly close to it. I mean, and that's just who ends up in the city. I mean,
yeah,
obviously
yeah.
on the West Coast, you know,
well,
a large
Mexicans
Asian population.
Are cooking the food in all the restaurants, not just in the Mexican restaurants.
I think that, you know, it's an important point. When, for instance, there's enough of an Asian population mm-hmm. to support Chinese restaurants, for instance, where the cooks and the restaurateurs don't have to concern themselves with suiting what they see as Western taste. That's when you start mm-hmm. getting the good stuff. It is my firm belief that where there are large Asian communities, food gets better. There is no more significant moment in the history of American cuisine that one of the tipping points for all of us was that one moment when American-born people suddenly decided that it was okay and, in fact, desirable to eat sushi. everything changed. The expectation of quality of seafood, the varieties that we were suddenly then able to use in traditional French and Italian restaurants, traditional, you know, oily little fish from Italy and Spain and France. Suddenly we could serve those things where we couldn't before. The quality of both the cooking and the fish itself, the markets, all boats were lifted by that moment.
I saw a story someplace, I guess it was on television, I forget whose program, in which they were featuring some fellow, you know who he is, you will know his name, who runs the most expensive and supposedly
the most
sushi restaurant in New York. What's his name?
Masa Takayama. Yeah. And I went there a few months ago. Dinner for two cost me $1,700.
Oh, come on.
And it was easily the most just, I embarrassed myself there. I just kind of rub his Tanoki wood bar and gape longingly at his Otoro tuna, which he has been known to pay $300 a pound wholesale for.
But you stopped me with $1,700 for a dinner for two, was it?
Two people for about 15 courses of the most incredible ingredients.
Did you pay out of your own pocket, or was this part of
No, I paid out of my own pocket.
Really?
And I, even if I made nothing, if I was blowing 2 months' rent and I had to put myself in debt, if I had to stick up a liquor store in order to get the money to eat there at least once, if you're any kind of a foodie, it's worth it. I ate there with the chef of Le Bernardin, which is maybe the best seafood restaurant in the country, and halfway during the meal, I hear this sort of really kind of embarrassing moaning coming from next to me, and I look over and it's the chef going, you know, Eric Repair going, oh yeah, this is good. Oh my God, this is great.
Yeah, I had his food in L.A. before he went out to New York, and
What did you pay for your meal?
I think it was $500 a person, and that was with no booze. So it was $700-$800 a person, and just the most incredible parade of ingredients. You know, blowfish collar, blowfish sperm, blowfish, everything, you know, caviar, white truffles, things that you wouldn't necessarily expect in Japanese cuisine, you know, just, and then after the 10 or 12 courses, he starts making sushi for you one piece at a time.
Oh, yeah.
And that was, I could have eaten, honestly, 100. I mean, I think everyone else dropped off. I'm not a big eater, but I just kept saying more and more and more. And
no plates, no glassware, no flowers, no display of fish. It's a man, a knife, a pile of incredible ingredients, much of which you, especially the latter part of the meal, you take from his fingers with your hands and pop in your mouth.
Uh-huh.
And it is tuna in particular, undreamed of by mortals.
Did you have the sinew from bluefin tuna? That was one that killed me. The when you separate layers of tuna in the belly, there are these pieces of sinew. And he took the sinew off very carefully. You watch him right there. And then he tenderized it with the blade of his knife and then grilled it on this little grill that he has a comey or a little helper bringing him coals for. And then he puts it on top of the rice and you eat it. And it was just like, you got to be kidding me. I've thrown this stuff out. And I couldn't do it like he did it in a million years. But it was absolutely incredible.
This is in a different realm when it comes to chefs, isn't it?
Are there
other practitioners of yet other cuisines who are that perfect and that expensive elsewhere in the world?
Not such an ingredient-driven example. You know, when you're paying that kind of money elsewhere, most examples I can think of.
Ducasse, maybe?
You're talking some serious razzle-dazzle. You're talking about food that it takes 50 people to cook
Where?
For 50 customers. Alain Ducasse in Paris at the Plaza Athénée or the French Laundry. You're talking the very, very best ingredients.
The French Laundry's
Napa Valley.
Yeah, Napa Valley. What's a good meal at the French Laundry cost?
Fairly reasonable.
Yeah, I think it's under $200 for a tasting menu.
Well, that's not the same thing, is it?
It's what you spend on wine.
But it's an extraordinary procession of tiny portions. Quite beautiful,
now this
but
time,
a lot
Maza,
of personnel.
Is that his name, Maza?
Maza, but it's Maza. Him and two assistants. That's it.
But how many customers are in the room at any time?
Nine seats at the bar. And two tables.
There was less in L.A., I think it was.
Uh-huh.
And he's famous for throwing people out if you arrive 2 minutes late.
Uh-huh.
If, God help you, if you ask for a California roll, you don't like sushi, get out.
where is he in Manhattan?
He's in the Time Warner building in Columbus Circle.
I see. Well, I must drop in there next time I'm in New York, but what's the cheapest meal I can get there?
No, there's no menu. You go in and you just eat what he tells you to eat.
And you pay what he asks.
And you pay what he asks. And if you want it, if he notices you like something, as all really great sushi chefs do, he's very much examining your reaction as the meal progresses and making decisions based on that.
Uh-huh.
At various points, it becomes entirely appropriate to say, I think I need more of that, which is going to cost you.
When I was a lad, hanging around Paris, a long time ago, in this I'm lording it over the two of you because I'm older than either of you, I dined one night at, served by Fernand Poin.
Oh, my gosh.
At
the Pyramid? Well,
at the Pyramid.
The Pyramid in Vienne.
Wow.
Near Lyon. And he was at that time considered the greatest chef, at least the greatest French chef.
Yeah, in the world.
In the world. I want to know what great chefs you've encountered apart from Mazza in New York. We'll talk about that when we return right after this. Some of the best things or the most fascinating that are said around this table are said while the commercials are playing. And our conversation ran in a certain direction, and I asked Anthony Bourdain, what's the average longevity of chefs? And your answer was?
I don't know. I mean, I know that it was back in the 20s, when there was poorer ventilation, something like 37 or you know, 40 was a... You were old if you were a chef. Most died from coal fumes, bad ventilation, heat, alcoholism. It's still very low. I mean, I've heard figures as low as 57 as being some
kind of
average.
Well, that's about 20 years lower than the average for American males.
Yeah, that's not good, but nor is it surprising. It's physically very, very demanding work.
Really?
You know, it's long hours. A little time off, and of course, very, very high stress in an environment where alcohol and food are essentially free,
and a lot of both are imbibed or ingested.
You know, even moderately, with the kind of hours, the heat, working conditions, and I think most importantly, the pressure. That's a lot of wear and tear.
How old are you now, Tony?
I'm 49, and I felt. My abilities declining. I mean, the physical abilities, I felt that first, the knees, the back, the arches of the feet.
Standing up all night.
Standing up and doing a lot of deep knee bends and running up and down stairs.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. But I think your mental, I mean, I felt my brain starting to fry also, you know, just to expedite, to stand there and call out orders and control the movements of a very busy kitchen. You know, I realized at about 45, I'm not getting any better at this.
Well, let's examine the longevity of some of the great chefs. I mentioned one just a moment ago, Fernand Poin. I don't know how old he was when he died, but I met the man once, as I said. Would he have been in his early 60s,
how...
I would, or thereabouts?
Yeah, don't know. What about a fiery temper?
It's all changing. You know, the demands on a chef now go far beyond the kitchen. I mean, you have a successful restaurant, they try to drag you out and make you cook all over the country, and you know, you got to write a book, you got to do this, you got to do that. So the pressure gets greater and greater, and it's more difficult to cook in your own kitchen. And for me, that's sort of where my internal pressure
comes
from.
What's the burnout rate? The advertising game, I saw there was a study years ago, and I've checked it out with people I know who are in the ad business, and they confirmed this is the case. The average length a full career is about 8 years. That is, you go into it,
wow,
and you burn out or you get fired or you go into something else on the average about 8 years later. What's true of chefs in that regard?
Well, for cooks. Let us assume
cooks,
a situation
chefs, yeah.
Of all of the kids who come rolling out of cooking schools or of anyone who comes out of cooking schools who've been through your restaurant, how many, what percent do you think are still in the business?
Well, I just had this conversation with someone the other day. I look at those kids and I say, one out of 200 kids that comes and cooks in my kitchen is going to go on and be a chef and have their own restaurant. It takes a crazy mentality. You got to just kind of like getting smacked in the head a lot. It's like someone's always tapping you in the head with a baseball bat, and you got to keep going.
Well, the cooks who come work for you, do they remain cooks?
Or most of them change careers.
They do change careers.
And I'm not a brutal screamer in the kitchen, you know. I try to make it fun, and I try to make it a great learning environment. But it's long hours, it's low pay. You got to be a really driven individual, and you got to have a lot of self-confidence to push through to where you actually will make some money eventually.
It's low pay. How low?
Oh, boy, I don't want to get myself in trouble here, but I think the average cook, entry level in a kitchen, a good kitchen in Chicago, walks away with no more than $500 for a week. Taxes and everything taken
really?
Out, of course. So
the waiters make more.
By far. And that's a big problem. A guy will come in and work 5 or 6 hours and make three times the money.
Uh-huh. Which tends to explain some of the rivalry or tension between the people in the kitchen and the people on the floor.
I think to some extent that's been overstated. We all, you know, we hate waiters for 5 minutes during a busy shift, but at the end of the shift, we're all part of the same dysfunctional family. I think most cooks know instinctively that for love or money, there's no way we could stand out there and deal with the general public. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the Paul is talking about these added pressures. I think so many of us of a certain generation got into the business because we had poor communication skills and unlovely personal habits, and found the perfect mix of order, very important, but also chaos and forgiveness in the kitchen, an environment in which we could make good, a refuge for misfits. That it's ironic that now so much of the job, almost an obligation to your business, is the need to be able to present yourself, you know, to TV cameras or to reporters, to schmooze, to work the dining room, to do events, to basically behave in public in a way I think that kind of demand came as a real surprise to a lot of chefs.
When did chefs start becoming television stars? Who was the first?
Jacques Pepin, maybe? Julia Child.
Because Julia Child, yeah, but Julia never...
Julia was not...
She never worked a restaurant.
Right. Right. More like a I see her as more of a saint than a chef. But I think there was always a small sector of people targeted towards home cooks. Pepin was certainly a groundbreaker, very important to figure on many levels. But no, something happened sometime in the 70s or I guess early 80s, where going to restaurants became entertainment. And who was cooking became important, and in much the same as who was in the movie, who was on the baseball team. Expectations of chefs changed, and the place that dining out had in just American social life changed. I don't know when that happened, but it really did happen. Instead of going to movies, and discussing it with your friends, you go to dinner and discuss it with your friends, and it becomes a long conversation. That whole dynamic changed.
I mean, really, there was one great restaurant in Chicago, which never really disclosed who was doing the cooking. I speak of Le Nomade, run by Jovan Terbojevich, mm-hmm. and in Jovan's earlier restaurants as well. He was the central figure. He was le patron.
Right.
He was out there on the floor, but you never really knew who was back in the kitchen doing the cooking, though the food was very good and much celebrated.
I think that's true of Le Pavillon in New York, too, back in that era, where the maitre d'hotel was the guy that was the face of the restaurant.
Yeah, that doesn't exist anymore at all.
Well, first of all, you have a very hard time finding a waiter who knows how to, fillet a Dover sole table side and does that kind of old-school European service. And you'd have a hard time finding people who want to endure that kind of a meal.
I think it's the Food Network had a lot to do with it, just like MTV kind of changed the music industry.
What did the Food Network do?
Emeril, bam.
He's the big culinary star on television still, is he?
Well, there's a lot of them. It's kind of changing. It's not so much the guy out of the kitchen anymore. It's sort of these young women that appeal to everyone in America.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel Ray... Who are the other ones?
There are two now. Food Network is such a huge phenomena that there are chefs who they're TV chefs, but they are actual chefs. I mean, Emeril came up through the system. He was a real cook, a real chef, a guy who built a significant empire.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to forget that when you see him on TV, it looks silly. Mario Batali. These are real chefs, and in fact, they are being slowly and inevitably squeezed out by kind of instant chefs. Add water and mix, find Weather Girl, add water, mix, put on TV, and you've got, Rachel Ray.
I'm afraid I don't know Miss Ray.
Basically, anyone will do, as long as they're charming on television, you can create a brand about them, and they don't lop off their fingers when handed a knife.
Well, you've been much on television in recent years,
mm-hmm.
Anthony Bourdain. And you insist on the American pronunciation, Bourdain, though it's a French name.
Yeah.
It should be pronounced Bourdain.
Bourdain, yeah.
But have you done cooking on television?
No, not really.
You've run around the world lately in different television series eating and talking about what you're eating.
If some network, a television network, is silly enough to give me a lot of money to travel anywhere I want in the world and eat and drink too much and have a really good time with absolute total freedom to choose where I go, I will be happy to milk that opportunity for everything I can get, and I'm having a lot of fun doing that.
Of course, your book of a few years ago, and that's when I met you, when you were touring in promotion of the book Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly, was a surprising sensation, wasn't it?
Sure surprised me. I mean, I wrote a, I thought a few restaurant insiders in New York would read it, and hopefully it would be a tiny cult success in the New York tri-state area at best. It's in 24 languages in 30 countries now. And
what it brought to my mind when I read it originally was the classic work by George Orwell, Down and Out in Paris and London, in which he reports his life working in the kitchens of some of the great restaurants of Paris.
It was an important book for me, for that book. It was very much
he
an influence.
He discloses all the dreadful stuff that happens, including, of course, the chef spitting in the soup.
Yeah. I have to say, it was not my intention to write an expose. I just wanted the cooks, the people who read it in the business, to say, this is not bogus. That's what my life was coming up in those years. Now, that being said, the business has changed a lot. Now that for whatever reasons, cooking has become a glamour profession, it would be unheard of. I mean, back in the early 70s, when there was no hope or ambition in kitchens, you could spit in soup and you would not be chastised. Now you would be betraying the entire kitchen's hopes and dreams. Mm-hmm. It's almost unthinkable in any kind of a good restaurant that anyone would do that.
We're overdue for some commercials. I've just looked up on my screen, and Maggie, our producer, who's always very quick to pick up on these things, obviously went to the internet to check out Fernand Foin, and she tells me he died at 57.
Oh, my God.
We return directly after this. We're kind of schmoozing around tonight, talking about restaurants, about the life of very active and successful chefs, and we're talking with two of people in that very category, Paul Kahn, who is the chef and partner at Blackbird, at 619 West Randolph, as all serious eaters in Chicago know, and Anthony Bourdain, who is the executive chef at Brasserie Leal in New York, when he's there. But you seem to be a lot elsewhere very often.
Yeah, I'm pretty much I'm traveling almost full-time, making TV these days.
His previous books include Kitchen Confidential and Cook's Tour in Search of the Perfect Meal, and, of course, you've done two published mysteries, I gather.
Three crime novels, A Small History of Typhoid Mary, and a cookbook.
You're pretty busy. Do you guys agree with Calvin Trillin, who's given lots of good advice about dining and the pleasures of dining, who says, avoid restaurants with names that are improbable descriptions, such as Purple Goose, the Blue Kangaroo, or the Quilted Orangutan?
I'm with him on that.
Are you?
Yeah.
The Quilted Giraffe was a great restaurant, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's always an exception to the rule, but
I remember a great French restaurant just off the original Leal, Le Cochon qui Fume, the Smoking Pig.
That sounds reasonable to me. I can picture that.
Anything with pork in the name
yes.
is okay. So,
yeah.
Without a doubt.
Let's talk about the book that you are contributors to, both of you, as together with some 25 or more.
I think 40.
40
together, yeah.
Colleagues. Titled, Don't Try This at Home. Culinary Catastrophes from the World's Greatest Chefs. And that's published by, who is it published by?
Bloomsbury.
By Bloomsbury. It's edited by Kimberly Witherspoon and Andrew Friedman, but we didn't stop to say much about them, except they're foodies one way or another, I gather. Let's talk about your adventures and misadventures. I quite enjoyed your chapter, Paul. It wasn't exactly a catastrophe, but it was an amusing occasion.
Well, you know, since I've been a chef, I get asked to do demonstrations quite often, and the Viking Range Corporation asked me to do a demonstration. They kind of tricked me. They said it's not a real big deal. There won't be a lot of people there. You know, da 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 da. They said there's gonna be a little cafe set up to serve 50 people at a time, and I had to do the same demonstration three times in a row. And it was in the Grand Ballroom at Navy Pier, which I think full can probably hold about 10,000 people. And I walked in about 2 hours before to see a giant banner of myself across the room. And, of course, this was an event where all the top-named chefs in Chicago and some nationally were cooking, and I don't fancy myself as a real you know, big shot. So right off the bat, I was a little thrown off my feet and a little freaked out by the whole thing. But, you know, I made the best of it. I figured I got to do this, you know, got everything set up. And when the event started, you know, there was probably about 2,500 to 3,000 people watching my little demonstration, and I had forgotten that I had my cell phone in my pocket. And kind of a defining part of my career is that, you know, I really love my wife, and chefs don't spend a lot of time with their significant other. So we've developed this thing where when she calls, I listen to her. And even if it's in the middle of the day, if I'm in the middle of, she knows when service is, but if she calls, I'll spend 10 minutes and I'll listen to what she has to say and we'll catch up. Because there are often times when we don't see each other for 3 or 4 days in a row because of conflicting schedules. Well, my cell phone was in my pocket and I forgot to turn it off. And I was mic'd and my assistant was mic'd and I heard the cell phone start to ring and I reached in my pocket and the identifier said Mary Klonowski, my wife's name. And I thought, you know, God forbid if something really horrible, you know, if she was in some kind of trouble or something.
You had to answer, of course.
Yeah, I had to answer it. So I answered the phone and it was really difficult to let her know that I was in front of a couple thousand people doing a demo. So I said, yes, honey, and I went on. And it was
with the audience hearing all of it.
With the audience hearing the whole thing. And it was about, it probably went on for 2 or 3 minutes, and finally I said, Mayor, I said, I'm in front of 3,000 people right now doing a demo. And she just burst out into laughter. And, you know, our normal sign-off to our conversations is I love you. And I didn't even think twice about it. And I said, I love you. And you heard the biggest, oh, from every woman, everyone in the crowd.
Just did you blush?
I blushed a little bit. And then I said, enough of this. Let's go on with the demo. So,
great.
And I went ahead and did it. I think the editors thought it was a little bit off the beaten path and not the normal kitchen disaster story, which, believe me, I have thousands of those, but it was a little unique.
Whereas Tony, in his chapter, describes a true disaster.
Worst night I've ever had in the restaurant business. I was a cook,
New Year's chef. Eve, wasn't it?
New Year's Eve, 1991, working for a very talented chef at a busy nightclub restaurant. And the chef had just not shared important information with his cooks, like what we were making that night, the menu, you know, everything. And he had designed a menu very badly where most of the dishes came off one section. One person was making the majority of dishes. They're, you know, unnecessarily stressing one part of the team. And, you know, we all of us as chefs, I think, have nightmares trying to anticipate all of the things that might go wrong, assuming that one or two or maybe even three of them will go wrong. And on this night, absolutely everything went wrong. 350 people, they paid a lot of money for their New Year's dinner, sat there drinking champagne, getting belligerent drunk, and they just weren't getting their food. The kitchen just went down in flames. And I think Paul will agree, it's never a good sign when waiters stop complaining or stop asking for food. When there's total silence from the floor, it's a very bad thing. And when I turned around and saw that all the waiters were hiding in the kitchen, silent, afraid to go out on the floor, afraid to complain to the chef, I knew that we'd lost control and we were never going to get
the
it
orders
back.
Came in and you just couldn't get the food out. Is that it?
They were just buried. You know, the printer went down. You know, so orders that were just backing up in the computer, but
serving?
We weren't getting them.
What were you serving?
A very elaborate meal: a truffle soup en croûte or a pan-seared foie gras. You know, a choice of four or five rather elaborate appetizers, followed by another course, followed by yet another, and just. Everything went wrong, and the increasingly drunk diners started abusing their waiters, started walking out. I should point out that because we were a nightclub for much of our operation, security that night were not used to dealing with the dining public. They were used to dealing with a fairly rough nightclub clientele. So things got physical, and it just got uglier and uglier and uglier. And though it was easily the worst night I've ever had in the restaurant business, it was also, from a chef's point of view, very instructive. I mean, I learned all of the things to be avoided by that experience. And I think it's a common thread in all of the chef's stories, how they deal with the unexpected, how they deal with something going wrong, how they innovate, improvise, or correct.
I read that chapter with great interest, and I learned that the organization of the kitchen is very important.
Yeah.
And that there are different stations doing different things. There is some food that's already prepared. And the whole sort of systems theory of the kitchen, I don't understand, but obviously you guys do. How do you organize a kitchen for a restaurant like Blackbird or a restaurant like Leal in New York?
Well, in our particular case, we're very limited by space. Our kitchen where we cook all the food, we have a prep area, but the kitchen where we prep all the food is about 15 feet long, and it's five guys that stand shoulder to shoulder.
Uh-huh.
So the way we organize is it's very tight, it's very streamlined. You know, the dishes on the menu are divided up by meat and fish, vegetables, you know, cold food and hot appetizers. And each guy is in charge of doing their separate thing. And
there's division of labor. Each cook is in charge of either meat or fish or vegetables or salads or whatever.
Exactly.
And very often it's an assembly line operation, is it?
Not in our particular case. Part of my philosophy is I like for cooks to start and finish a dish. They come in the morning, they prep everything for their particular dishes, and then during service they're in charge of all the details for that.
What does that mean to prep something for the dishes you're going to be doing?
Chopping vegetables, butchering meat, making the bases for sauces that might be finished in a pan later, and on and on and on. There's a whole bunch of raw products that have to be turned into things that you can use at an instant and then turn them into a finished plate within, say, less than 10 minutes.
And I think depending on your space and your ambitions for the quality of your restaurant, how far you bring along those prepared or pre-prepared ingredients is, that's the kind of trade-off you have to make, chefs have to decide on all the time. If it's a very large restaurant, high volume, you obviously have to prepare things more than perhaps a smaller, higher quality. There's always going to be a compromise between quantity and quality. When you're running a place like Blackbird, Paul's Place, I would imagine that they prepare as little as possible beforehand so that things are made a la minute, from their most pristine, freshest, least prepared state to finished.
Layala is a bigger operation, isn't it?
We're what we would call, we're a very traditional bistro brasserie, what we call affectionately a turn and burn operation, meaning, we sell a lot of steak frites. Expectations of us are a simple but yet authentic French rustic regional meal. Mm-hmm. So we, our beef bourguignon is fully cooked before you even arrive in the restaurant. We just heat it and serve it, which actually in the case of beef bourguignon is a good thing. It does get better.
Well, beef bourguignon, that's sort of a stew.
Right.
So you can take it out of a big stew pot.
Right. But because it's a small kitchen that serves, up to 350 meals, in 6 hours, with only five cooks, with a big menu, we have a lot of that stuff as prepared as we can without making the food, not good. You have to make those decisions in a lot of different ways, on a case-by-case basis and in general.
What's the command system like? You both operated as chefs. How do you get the best out of your soldiers?
Well, the Escoffier developed what's called the brigade system. So it is run on a kind of
a military
model, meaning there is one chef whose policy is implemented by a number of, a chef de cuisine or a sous chef below, who then have chefs de partie. It flows downhill.
And we should remember, chef means chief.
A cook who leads.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I agree. Our kitchen's a little different. I try to hire young men and women that really want to do great food, and I instill a lot of trust in them. Of course, I watch what they do and go over it and criticize and tell them exactly the way I want it and taste over and over and over again. But I think if you start with someone that's just not a food warmer, that is a cook, wants to be a chef, the level of what you're doing is going to be a lot higher. And I think I've had pretty good success with that so far, just hiring really really determined young people.
In Chicago, Paul, apart from your place, what are the places that you really admire for how well they do what they do?
Wow,
I'm not talking just about the quality of the food, but the efficiency of the restaurant operation.
I'm a big fan of the restaurants that Sean McClain owns, Spring and Green Zebra. I think Green Zebra is an all-vegetarian restaurant. They have a couple meat dishes, I guess. But I really think what they do is special. I don't think anyone cooks vegetables quite as well. Over the years, Charlie Trotter's gotten a lot of thumbs up and thumbs down from people. And I think he's really at the forefront of cuisine in this town. I think he has a great chef de cuisine running his kitchen. I think the level of what they do there gets, the bar goes up every day. They use the best products. Every time I eat there, I'm more impressed. Who else? Le Bouchon, a little French bistro in Bucktown, cooks great food. I love what that man does over there. you know, there's a Persian restaurant in my neighborhood called Nuna Kebab, and I think they just made the pita is made there. It's really fresh. The feta is incredible. Everything's incredible. And the list goes on and on and on. I think there's a lot of great examples.
Tony, you've been dining around Chicago on and off over the years, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, I agree. Trotter is probably certainly the most famous, probably the most important to the Chicago dining scene historically. I think, you know, the technique there, the quality of food, everything is impeccable. I suffer from fine dining fatigue. I'm jaded.
Yeah.
So for me, I would rather eat at Avec, for instance. It was such a joy for me to eat good food at a counter.
That's Paul's other place.
Yeah. I am, with some exceptions, for me to do a 16-course tasting menu with formal service has really become a burden. Alain Ducasse's New York for me, you know, 13 courses there or 11 courses was like a year with an ugly mob. I've had enough of the, you know, when the water sommelier comes over, I just want to hang myself.
The water sommelier?
Yeah, I know. There's a sense of self-seriousness.
Is there really one?
Yes, and pomposity that I'm tiring of, and I think that's because I'm jaded. I eat around a lot.
Yeah.
But you know, I think you really have to hand it to guys like Charlie Trotter, Rick Tramonto, expensive Mexican dude,
Frontera,
very important.
Rick Bayless, then.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you for the most part, and that's kind of why Avec's doing so well. I mean, everyone loves.
I love sitting at that counter and eating good stuff from cooks who know how to make good stuff.
And it's not a four-hour experience. If you want to make it an hour or two, that's all it is.
We are due for some commercials and then a quick newscast, and then we shall return to Anthony Bourdain and to Paul Kahn, and in a while, onto your phone calls. Anything this conversation stirs up in your own mind, whether by way of questions or memories or, for that matter, diatribes. 591-7200 is the number. You know where to reach us, 591-7200. We pause for these words. And directly back to Anthony Bourdain, executive chef at Brasserie Leal in New York. Do they say Leal or do they say Leal?
Leal.
They do, as properly they should. Previous books include Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly, and A Cook's Tour in Search of the Perfect Meal. That was the volume in coordination with the television series. And what are the others?
Oh, let's see. Three crime novels, Bone in the Throat, Gone Bamboo, The Bobby Gold Stories, A History of Typhoid Mary, a cookbook called The Leal Cookbook, and... then, of course, this Don't Try This at Home, just one story of many.
The one we're featuring tonight, Don't Try This at Home, with chapters by some 40 or so, or is it more, cooks, and two of them being our two guests tonight, Anthony Bourdain and Paul Kahn. Kahn is spelled K-A-H-A-N. His restaurant is Blackbird on Randolph, and he was... one of the Food and Wine magazine's best new chefs way back in 1999, and he won the James Beard Foundation Award for Best Chef in America Midwest Region in 2004. Our phone number is 591-7200. If you are listening to us on some other continent and want to talk about the cuisine of Thailand or the cuisine of Morocco, the best way is to do it via email. The email address, extension 720, at tribune.com. Gentlemen, to strike a Dickensian note, it was the best of meals, it was the worst of meals. And I mean meals that were seriously intended. What stays in your memory? Even I, not a chef, have memories of some wonderful, a particular wonderful meal in a place that presumed to be a serious restaurant, and a dreadful meal in a place that presumed to be an even more serious restaurant. What are your memories in those two categories?
Boy, I don't want to embarrass anyone. No worse meals for me. Maybe I'll think of something. But
well, elsewhere, not in Chicago.
Yeah, but the best meal that I can remember, and maybe it's because I was sort of a newbie and I had just started cooking, but my wife and I went on a trip up the Rhone Valley in France, and the last place we ate at was a very famous restaurant called Alain Chapelle, and he was still alive, and it was really my first Michelin 3-star experience, you know, 27 cooks in the kitchen, 8 diners in the dining room, and it was just an incredible parade of ingredients that I never imagined, and presentations and attention to detail that I didn't even think was possible. I mean, I've had a lot of great meals since then, but that's always the one that I go back to. And I think I've become a little jaded as time goes on. It's always hard to go back to that first great one and top it. So that would be my number one.
I think the French Laundry was an incredible meal for me in Napa Valley.
What was
just the meal? 20 courses. All with appropriate wines. I mean, as far as a white tablecloth
meal. You mean 20 different wines?
Close to it, yeah. The party of four, I think we knocked off at least 12 or 14 bottles. As far as white tablecloth traditional service meals go, that was the one that really impressed me, largely because it was whimsical, soulful, fun. There was an element of, though it was very formal service, it was casual. The environment conspired to make the food enjoyable to eat, the right balance between context and food and a creative chef. I have to say, though, that my greatest meals, most pleasurable meals over the last few years have been a bowl of pho, you know, Vietnamese noodle soup on a low plastic stool in a, you know, on the sidewalk in Vietnam, or you know, Hainanese chicken rice in a hawker stand in Singapore, or you know, very, very simple things made essentially in one chef, one dish establishments.
Yeah.
You know, where one guy's been making Peking style duck for four generations. That's all he does. Chances are it's good. And when you've been to Beijing, as I haven't gone to the duck place, that's pretty good.
Worst meal. Where the pretensions led you to expect or to hope for something good.
Worst. You know, I ate a flawlessly cooked meal at Alain Ducasse in New York. I mean, perfection, the best ingredients, perfect execution,
but
perfect service. It was like Morticia Adams' theme restaurant. It was the most morbid, grim, suffocating, and just unfun experience.
This is the place that had the sommelier for water.
Yeah, or, you know, they wheel over the cart. You know, it was just oppressively formal in a very dark, stodgy room, and it just you felt like you had to behave, that you had to sit upright for your waiter, that you had to watch your, you know. To me, a good meal, you should feel free to eat with your hands, pass plates to your friends, talk a little loud, get a little drunk, have a good time, and this. I think that the level of the self-seriousness was a minus. It detracted from what otherwise would have probably been a really great meal.
The last time I was in Paris, only a few years ago, with some friends, I went at their intention to the dining room in the Hotel Georges V. And I had the very same feeling. That's not necessarily a great restaurant, but it's a haute cuisine sort of style. And you felt that you were sitting up and behaving for the waiters,
Yeah. I know. I just think the food that makes me angry now is it fake? If they're pretending to be, you know, if it's sort of French Thai fusion and the chef clearly has no understanding of Thai food, maybe spent 2 weeks on vacation there and came back and started throwing coconut milk and lemongrass.
One of the great disasters in Chicago restaurants, I think. I only went there once when it had these pretensions. Was a place run by this celebrated New York chef. Vong, what's his? Von Gerichten, is that his name? And this was the one that was a fusion of Thai and French, supposedly.
Really, and it wasn't good.
I didn't think so.
It was very successful in New York. I never went to the one in Chicago.
It's still there, but it's now gone real Thai.
Yeah.
The high Thai.
They've changed it up a few times.
Yeah.
But Chicagoans are tough. They don't respond to the same stuff that New Yorkers do.
Yeah, and I think it's vice versa.
The ultimate measure of that is that they opened right on Rush Street some while ago. What's the famous hot dog place in Coney Island?
Oh, Nathan's.
Nathan's. They opened a Nathan's right here on Rush Street. It lasted for about 6 months.
And it deserved to close. Nathan's, no, New Yorkers, we don't see Nathan's as the apex of New York hot dogdom.
No.
And when you're up against Gold Coast or Wiener's Circle, bringing in a, you know, from what my point of view, a mediocre chain franchise dog, that was a pretty dumb
move. Well, when I was a kid growing up in Brooklyn, Nathan's was the great place for hot dogs.
Yeah, but any New Yorker knows it's a Grace Papaya King. Is you know, that's as good as we get. And I have to say, and I hate admitting this, I've reluctantly come to believe that the hot dogs are best in Chicago.
Yeah, baby.
Really?
Yeah, I do like those red hots.
Interesting judgment. We're going to get onto the phones in just a few minutes. We'll take care of some commercials again right now, and then your calls and your emails. I see one line still available, but if you on 591-7200, but if you try to reach us and hit the busy signal, of course, your best strategy is to call again right after we say goodnight to a prior caller. 591-7200. And our email has infinite capacity, so you can reach us that way as well. That address is extension 720 as one word at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com. We return after this. And we go to the phones and to the email in just an instant. But first, Tony, you're actually spending 3 or 4 days in Chicago rather than in Hanoi City.
Yes.
Or Ho Chi Minh City.
Yes.
What are you up to?
Tomorrow I'm doing a book signing, reading, Q&A at the Chopping Block at the Merchandise Mart from 6 o'clock to 9 p.m. And Wednesday at the Art Institute of Chicago, a book signing at 10:45 a.m. and then a lunch event from 11:45 to 2.
At the Art Institute? That's an unusual venue for a touring author.
Well, food's not art.
Sounds good. And we are going to go to the phones. I see one line available again. A moment ago it was taken, but not everybody gets through, you know. 591-7200 is the number. Call us quickly if you want to be heard. If you hit the busy signal, keep trying, and sooner or later somebody will get through. You are the first. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
I've been listening since the top of the show, and it's been very interesting. One thing that sticks in my mind is that the majority of the people around here, at least the people I hang around with, have a limited budget for dining. And I'm looking for some advice from Paul or Anthony or whomever as to how can someone find quality at that's not going to cost me $400 a plate, or what should I be looking for?
Or how about $1,700 for a dinner for two?
Well, I heard about
it. $1,700.
I mean, the average Chicagoan, I don't think, can afford something like that. I wish I could, and I don't have a budget that I can continue to go and to check from restaurant to restaurant until I find something that's of good quality. You know, what should I be looking for?
I mean, I'm going to pass the question to Paul, who obviously knows Chicago a lot better than I do, but my general instinct would be to say, when in doubt or on a budget, seek out genuine ethnic, whatever ethnicity, immigrant communities. The first thing other cultures bring to America when they come are their markets, their supply train, and their food. And this is a good thing in every case I can think of.
Yeah, I agree 100%. One place that comes to mind right away, I don't know where you live, but it's in Logan Square, and it's called Lula Cafe. They're open breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They use the same level ingredients that the greatest chefs in the city use. They seek out pure, beautiful, organic products. And they,
what cuisine is that?
I would say it's American cuisine.
Uh-huh.
They just do a great job there. So if you want a reasonable breakfast, lunch, or dinner, go to Lula. The other one, without too much tireless self-promotion, would be our second restaurant, Avec, which has been open for about 2 years now. It's small plates and large plates. The small plates range in price from $4 to about $13. It's a great place to go with a bunch of friends, share. The food is every bit as well prepared as the food at Blackbird. It's a little more rustic. It's a little more sort of peasant-driven, but it's a ton of fun. I think that's a good example.
Wouldn't it be fun, indeed I find it fun, to go to some of the neighborhoods which are rather ethnically specialized, to go to Devon Avenue and choose between the 10 or 15 Indian restaurants that you find on Devon?
Without a doubt. I do it all the time. I do it more than I dine at these temples of haute cuisine.
Yeah.
I prefer that.
This is where chefs eat after work, by the way. Mm-hmm. This is exactly the kind of eating at any level of chefing. Chance are you end up someplace that's open late, cheap, and ethnic.
Argyle is the location for Vietnamese restaurants.
You're almost always going to eat.
Have you been there?
I haven't, Argyle? But that is a particular passion of mine.
There must be 10 or 12.
Yeah, I shop there a lot. I eat pho there a lot.
Yeah.
Lawrence is also a great
for Korean
restaurants. Yeah. 24-hour Korean is a restaurant people flock to this place. It just says on the sign, 24-hour Korean, and you get bibimbap and all kinds of great stuff, and it's wonderful.
You guys, neither of you probably knew Jim McCauley, did you? Is the name familiar to you?
No.
He was a professor of linguistics, my thanks to that caller, at the University of Chicago. That's a colleague of mine. He was on this program rather often. He died far too young. He was a linguist, originally born in Australia, and he had a great love of Asian food. And he became a specialist on the Asian restaurants, the mom-and-pop Asian restaurants of Chicago. Every year, he turned out, originally intended just for graduate students at the University of Chicago, his guide to good Asian eating in Chicago. And it became a major item, so that after a while, people were clamoring for it, and it was distributed more broadly. And his basic philosophy, of course, was find a mom-and-pop place. Don't go to the ones that are hooked up.
It's really funny, at the highest, most, I guess, the elitist levels of sort of foodiedom in New York are the people they're not comparing experiences at three-star restaurants. They're talking about the hardest to find, dirtiest, smallest, most obscure mom and pop, you know, Ukrainian or Uzbekistani or Mongolian or Thai restaurant in the farthest outer reaches of the boroughs. That's real prestige to come back from one of those experiences and say, I found the most fantastic, you know, authentic Turkish restaurant in a, you know, with the back of a garage with no sign and, you know, chickens running around in the front lawn. That's real prestige when you come back from an experience like that, having found good food.
Back to the phones. 591-7200 is the number, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. First, Chef Khan, I want to tell you I ate at your restaurant Saturday night for my anniversary. It was a wonderful experience. Absolutely love the coffee there. I don't know what you serve.
Intelligentsia.
Ah. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good, good. It was wonderful.
Good.
The suckling pig. Oh.
Pork. Back to pork. Everyone loves pork.
It was fantastic.
Great to hear.
But my question to the two of you is, I have a young toddler. We cook for him almost every night. Loves to eat food. We don't go to McDonald's, places like that. What can I do to continue expanding his horizons? He eats Vietnamese chicken soup that I make, loves lentils, loves leeks, loves leeks. What do you guys suggest?
Well, I think what children like, what you learn to accept as being good or bad, texture, flavor-wise, is entirely learned behavior, as I understand it. So, I mean, now's the time to get wild and experiment. I mean, I know that most Americans, for instance, we tend to like crispy and reject anything that's chewy, squiggly, gelatinous, which excludes a lot of traditional Asian food. If you grow up eating that, or at least having it and recognizing it as something potentially good, that's a huge advantage over you know, more pedestrian eaters. So, I mean, I'm grateful to my parents for making me eat widely and experiment as a kid.
Yeah, I would have to say, have you been to the Green City Market?
We go there.
Yeah, I've walked through that market with Alice Waters and heard her say that it's the most diverse organic market in the country, certainly one of them. So when you take your kid there and there are those little plates of incredible peaches and, you know, 10, 20, 30 different kinds of apples, I think if you want to develop your kid's palate, let them taste five different kinds of apples and talk about it and expose them to great product. And that'll sort of set the precedent right from the get-go, I think.
Okay.
What and where is Green City Market?
It's the Chicago Organic Market. It's every Wednesday and Saturday, and it's in the parking lot, or actually in the lot next to the Chicago Historical Society at Clark and LaSalle.
Oh, I've passed it then. Sure.
Yeah, it's a lot more purveyors are there on Wednesday. It's an incredible market that's building thanks to a woman named Abby Mandel. Who
run through the whole day?
It's usually over. The farmers start at about 6 in the morning, and it's usually over by about 1 o'clock.
I see. Ma'am, thank you for the call.
Thank you for your help, gentlemen.
Sure.
Glad to have heard from you. And a number of lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, make another quick try, and you may very well get through on 591-7200. 591-7200. And, gentlemen, on to another caller. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a quick question for Anthony Bourdain. About a year ago, I met him at a signing for the bookstall of his cookbook, and we were going to New York with my dearest friend, and he sent us to Veritas. And it was one of the most wonderful meals I've had ever in my life. And now, by some strange twist of fate, I'm speaking to him again, and I'm going to Montreal in a week. And I'm wondering if he can. He spoke about Montreal earlier in the program, and I'm wondering if he could give me another recommendation, because Veritas, and we also went to La Zala, which was wonderful.
Glad you like. I'm thrilled you liked Veritas as well. That's one of my favorite restaurants. Well, Montreal, funny, you should ask, because Paul and I were just discussing the pied de cochon.
Pied de cochon.
Pied de cochon.
All right.
The pig's feet. The chef's name is Martin Picard. And I think just about anyone, you should be able to, your concierge or, the directory assistants will certainly get you there. I don't have the address, but it is really old school, insanely kind of a lumberjack French, heavy on the foie gras. It's a temple of overindulgence in a very loud, casual, fun way. And he's a very, very fine chef who I think kind of just freaked out on fine dining and just decided to serve really good ingredients in ridiculously huge portions. It's just a lot of fun. It's my favorite restaurant in Montreal.
Well, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
We thank you, ma'am. You know, it suddenly occurs to me that one place I like in Chicago a great deal, which sort of was like that, maybe not quite as heavy on the excess, but good cuisine bourgeoise without a lot of flummery, is Kiki's Cafe. Do you know it?
I don't know it, I don't think.
I know it. Is it still open?
Oh, yes. Kiki's been there for many years. He's a French guy. And it's very much like a good bistro, I think.
Yeah, I used to dine there quite often when John Hogan was the chef. I don't know if you know John Hogan, but haven't been back since. The food was incredible back then. I'm sure it still is.
They've got the greatest lamb navarin, the lamb stew. Mm. That you can find in Chicago, I think.
The way to get me to a restaurant is start talking about the pork. I agree with Homer Simpson that the pig is a magical animal, and I just hearing about Paul's suckling pig. I'm hungry already. Tell me about a place that does suckling pig or crispy pork or some kind of interesting pork dish, and I'm already halfway there.
By the way, along those lines, Paul, what do you have against chickens? I'd read something about you saying that you simply don't do chicken at your restaurant.
Well, that's incredible, because I just got interviewed for Nation's Restaurant News on the phone today by a woman, and it was about chicken. We do actually serve chicken at lunch. We do a half of an organic chicken that we get from a farm called Green Gold Acres outside of the city. It's a great dish. Really, what I have against it is I love chicken. I think it's incredible. And in fact, I just made roast chicken for my wife for dinner last night. It just doesn't sell at Blackbird. I think people come looking for a more grand dining experience. Chicken maybe seems a little run-of-the-mill to them. It doesn't fit with the environment. We did do a chicken dish earlier in the year that was, we've been talking about sous vide, or cooked in a bag. We did sous vide chicken breasts that was sliced paper thin and served over veal sweetbreads that were really crispy with sauce grabiche, kind of a pickled sauce. And that went over really well. So it's got to be paired with something that's a little more bourgeois, if you will. People just don't go for chicken.
You mentioned sous vide. That's because during some commercials I read you this. I'll now read it publicly. Would you ask Anthony or Paul if they believe the sous vide approach to cooking will last or be a passing experiment? Explain just what sous vide is.
Essentially, you place the item to be cooked. Well, you can, for instance, with a roast chicken, you could theoretically sear it in the pan, getting some brown color on it, and then put it into a plastic bag with maybe a little flavored butter, vacuum seal it, and then finish it the rest of the way either in a double boiler or in a convection oven, for instance.
So what does that do for
it,
you?
It keeps all of the moisture in,
uh-huh.
and you can cook it very low, at low temperatures, slowly over time. And some chefs are doing really, truly extraordinary things with it. Do I think it will last? I think, like a lot of trends in cooking and new developments, there will be those who overuse it. But I think, yes, I think it's going to be an enduring technique.
It's a great tool in preservation, too. You vacuum pack things, and they last a lot longer. So I think it's been around like that for a long time as well.
Another question as part of the same communication from the same listener. One other question. Do they use or have opinions about using a Pacojet for frozen desserts and for soups? I may be one of the very small minority to be fortunate enough to have one in my home kitchen. What is a Pacojet?
Pacojet is a small, really small batch freezer that you can essentially make ice cream in like 2 minutes. So you have your ice cream base, you put it in the Pacojet, you flip it on, and voila, ice cream. I don't know exactly how they work.
It's essentially, as I understand it, we have one at the restaurant. We call it the $5,000 Mr. Coffee. it's little cans with which you can freeze almost any ingredient. You put it in, you ratchet it into place, press a button, and sort of what appears to be a claw on an electromagnetic sort of layer pushes its way down at high speed, chopping essentially and whipping the frozen block of, let's say, strawberries and cream into a soft, frothy, nice, expensive toy if you can afford it.
Yeah, the
next big thing, no.
They break down quite a bit, and that's a problem. So, Paco Jet, no for me.
Yeah, the little plastic lids are a freeze and seem to crack, and they're incredibly expensive to replace. A nice toy.
Another probing question. How has the Internet changed food and accountability, both for better or for worse?
It's changed the restaurant. Whole restaurant criticism is becoming increasingly... How do you keep up? I mean, you review a place for... You review a restaurant, and by the time the review comes out, the chef has left, the menu's changed, and the food is either better or worse. Whereas on the Internet, you can go to a food website like eGullet or Chowhound or one of these sites, and, you know, people are reporting on an hourly basis on restaurants all over the world.
And it's people rather than experts. It's diners who are...
That's a huge key. I mean, you can go to any of these things and look at all the criticism, and for me, it's made my life many times miserable. I mean, who knows who this jackass is that's calling in? I mean, we're not perfect by any means. We make just as many mistakes as the next guy, but everyone is a critic, and everyone wants to let you know what their opinion is. And
now, those Zagat surveys are all based upon ordinary diners who are reporting on restaurants they've been to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Does Zagat bother you in the same way?
You know what? Actually, stick the knife in my heart and in my career. Yes, it does. I think the problem for me is we have a little bit of a different environment at Blackbird. It's very small. Quarters are very close. It's not the traditional grand fine dining with 10 feet between tables and a lot of room for fluid servers to perfectly deliver your food. We have to deal with some more difficult circumstances, but we've always made up for it with a great positive attitude from all of our staff, really great quality food and wine and service. And I don't think everyone necessarily sees it that way. Young and old people alike that are looking for that grand experience get it in a different way. Maybe they get to talk to the person sitting next to them and talk about the great meal that they had, but it's much more interactive, and hence it doesn't work for some people. So everyone getting out there on the Internet and spewing out their experience, some of it's, you know, there are a lot of wacky people out there, and some of it really comes across as such. So,
I think some of the websites are really valuable. The Zagat Guide I find very useful for the address and phone number of the restaurants and little else. I mean, it's a completely, the system makes no sense.
But which,
you could have a pizzeria, you know, get the same rating as the best restaurant in New York.
Which guides do you like?
The Zagat Guide is very useful because it has the address and the phone number.
That's it.
And in no other way is it to me. I don't know that there are any guides that I care about. I of course I care about the New York Times you know, dining section. It's important. Everybody reads it. The chefs read it as an industry thing. You know, there's nobody else. It's the standard in New York. It's, you don't necessarily live or die by it, but it makes a huge difference.
Now, Ruth Reichel, who used to be their critic a long time ago and is a big food person, and now she's the editor of Gourmet, is that right? She was here on the program just a few months ago, I guess. Now, do magazines of that sort have great influence in the dining business?
Not on which... If they do an article about your place, then which you mentioned, obviously that's a very good thing.
That's a good boost.
But restaurant criticism isn't really what they do so much. I mean, the Times, if you have aspirations to be a, you know, expensive fine dining restaurant, and you know you lose 2 stars, or you open and you only get 1 star, you're pretty much toast.
Do the newspaper restaurant critics here in Chicago, do you think, Paul, have much influence?
Very much influence.
They can boost or kill a restaurant.
They can boost or kill a restaurant, without a doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't need to say any more.
Similarly, Chicago Magazine.
I think the Tribune, more so than Chicago Magazine.
Uh-huh.
Chicago Magazine is a little more in-depth, but yeah, they make or break you, big time.
We pause some overdue commercials, then right back to the phones on 591-7200. Two of the large number of authors who put together the book Don't Try This at Home, Culinary Catastrophes from the World's Greatest Chefs, are our guests tonight. They are Anthony Bourdain and Paul Kahn. And we go back to your calls to them, 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes.
My name is Catherine Henrici, and I am the great-granddaughter of the founders of Henrici's Restaurants here in Chicago.
I remember that restaurant.
I know. Everybody does, and they remember it in such a wonderful way. And I've researched it. You know, it's unusual for any business, let alone a restaurant, to survive for 120 years. And I think the factors of its success was the people. I think it was the atmosphere in the restaurant. There was a good feeling. It was a home feeling. The people who came in were the politicians. Mayor Daley had his coffee.
It was on, Randolph, was it?
Right.
Yes.
And it was raised to make way for the Chicago Civic Center.
Uh-huh.
And it spun off and went into the Merchandise Mart. And the O'Hare Inn got the loan to build on the strength that Henrici's would do the food service.
But it doesn't exist to this day, does it?
No, it doesn't exist to this day, only in people's minds.
Wasn't there also, for a while, a New York branch?
Pillsbury acquired it through a merger.
Uh-huh.
Green Giant purchased it through a merger with Green Giant, and they were going to pull it out of Chicago, and I asked them, please don't do that. You don't know what this means to Chicago. But the memory of it still goes on. And it was always good food, plain food, but good food.
Yeah.
And it was a clubby atmosphere. It was a very warm...
You say it lasted for over 100 years.
120 years.
Who was the founder originally?
My great-grandfather, Philip Henrici.
Isn't that interesting?
He came here with Oscar Mayer and Brouwer and Louis Glunz. They were about 14 years old here.
Paul, do you think that Blackbird will last 120 years?
No.
Then who did?
He asked me if I thought Blackbird would be around for 120 years. And
well, ma'am, we appreciate the call, and we thank you very much for sharing that with us. Are there restaurants that have lasted that long in New York? I mentioned a favorite of mine from when I was a kid and even a young assistant professor up at New Haven, namely Luchow's.
Yeah.
How long it lived, I don't know, but it probably died a number of years ago.
Many, many, yeah. Yeah, it was on life support for some time before that. I mean, that was a grand...
It was a grand
style, big menu. I'm trying to think of places that really go back. You know, Peter Luger's, the Old Homestead. They're mostly steakhouses.
Uh-huh.
Limited, that's a timeless sort of a genre of restaurant. You know, it's immune to changes in tastes and times. You could pretty much, as long as you, in fact, they insist you stay. The 21 Club is pretty old, goes back almost 100 years, I think.
There's an article I read just the other day about 21. Was it in the New Yorker magazine or someplace?
I saw that article, yeah.
Yeah. 591-7200, on to another call. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, Milt. It's a great honor to speak with you. I've enjoyed your years of wonderful program.
Thank you, sir.
Great. I have a question as a psychologist, which I am, and also as a wine lover. First question is, can the great chefs tonight give us any insights into the personalities of some of the great chefs? What does it look like behind the line? What are the common characteristics that you find in the great chef?
Well, you're a psychologist, so that's a good psychologist question. But
yes.
I started with that question. You weren't with us at the very beginning.
I missed that one.
Yeah.
The second question is, where are the great chefs' philosophies of the integration of wine with food? How do they see wine? What part of it really excites them? What have they been exploring lately? Mm-hmm. Beyond the just red wine with red sauces. I'm a Francophile, and I love French wine, so any French wine plugs would be great.
Yeah, well, what about the wines of other countries, for that matter? I had a South African thing just the other night, which was surprisingly good.
I've been drinking some really good Australian wines over the last few years. It's getting better and better. You could certainly see the French read the writing on those. The ones who can have been, buying up property in Australia. They see the future, and I think a lot of the future for the French wine business, I mean, they're hidebound victims of their own success and preeminence. And I don't know, the future of wine might well be you know, goodbye to the cork, for instance. That's going to be a big change. There's a lot of debate over, you know, is it wise? Does the cork serve any kind of useful purpose other than a romantic one? In fact, it guarantees that you're losing a discouraging a proportion of your investment.
I think it's about 12%.
Yeah. So I don't know, you know, I'm drinking a lot of good wine all over the world, it's getting better in leaps and bounds.
I didn't understand the reference to the cork just now. What are you losing by way of a cork and why?
You want
to,
well, yeah, 12% of all the wines that you open are corked. The cork has tainted the wine, so the wine is no good. So a lot of winemakers are switching to synthetic corks and solving that problem and maybe creating some new problems.
What new problems come with the synthetics?
Well, wine's a living thing, and putting a wine in a bottle and closing it off to air takes care of that. So if it's a wine that's made to be drunk young, put a synthetic cork in it, pop it, and enjoy it. If it's a Bordeaux that you know, matures in the bottle over a 20 or 30-year period, a synthetic cork is not going to work. So it's an interesting issue right now. My plug would be for Portuguese wines. Right now there's a great grape called Touriga Nacional, really inky, intense, incredible. Both Portuguese whites and reds, I think, are really reasonable and really hot right now. And, of course, Spain, Priorat, the whole country, the wines are absolutely incredible and also very reasonable. So,
what would your waiter or sommelier do if a customer, having ordered sole, asks for a Pinot Noir with it?
Chill it. Chill it.
But you would serve it. You would reject a red with fish.
Oh, no. In fact, it's entirely appropriate sometimes. I like cooking fish with red wine, for
instance. Can do that.
Yeah, you know, we give the customer what they want. If you want us to destroy a perfectly good piece of sushi-quality tuna by overcooking it to the consistency of cat food, by days of weeping and rending garments and throwing plates is over, I will kill the food for you if you insist. Same with wine.
I greatly enjoyed your TV show. I love your personality. I love just your influences. Can you share any one of the most memorable bottles of wine or wine experiences you've ever had?
When I went to the Culinary Institute of America, I, me and a bunch of other juvenile delinquent friends broke into a room where apparently people would leave their wines, you know, they'd leave them to the school or will them to the school, and there was a case after case of loose bottles of wine covered with dust kicking around. And I liberated a bottle of old absinthe and another bottle of what said on the what appeared to be a 1962 Chateau Margaux.
Wow.
I brought it home. There was no one else around. I cracked the bottle, sat down with a big bag of potato chips, and I was watching, you know, like a really, you know, like The Odd Couple reruns. And I noticed a little tag on the bottle that said, decanted 1962 from a 1936 Chateau Margaux.
Holy cow.
It was an extraordinary bottle of wine, and it really went well with those chips.
It was probably worth about $500 at the time.
How is American wine received in some of the Asian countries? Do they kind of laugh at us, or are they more European-centric in their focus? Or?
I think they're fully aware of California wines, how good they are. Of course, you know, places like Japan, drinking French wine is a status, largely seen as a status symbol. They're going to stick with known names. But that's changing very, very quickly.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you.
You got to run. Some commercials are overdue. Here they are. The occasion, or the excuse at least, for putting this program together is the publication just recently of the book, Don't Try This at Home, Culinary Catastrophes from the World's Greatest Chefs. And two of those world's greatest chefs have been and continue to be our guests tonight. They are Anthony Bourdain and Paul Kahn. 591-7200 is the number, and we go to this caller. Hello, you're on the air.
How are you tonight?
Fine, ma'am. Go ahead.
I was wondering if either of your guests have an opinion on serving foie gras, whether or not the practice should be eliminated.
There's been a lot of fuss about that lately, hasn't there?
I'm absolutely for it. I think it's an essential ingredient to French cuisine. I think a lot of the discussion, there are various ways to raise foie gras. It's an easy victory it's an easy issue for people who are, of course, you know, no one likes to be cruel to animals, but this one is a tough, because it's enjoyed by so few people in the States, it's become an easy sort of a hot button issue. I think it would be a terrible and embarrassing development if, in fact, Illinois makes it illegal to raise, serve, or consume And I'm a supporter of the responsible use and raising of foie.
The issue is the stuffed feeding of.
I've seen the process.
Geese, right? Yeah, you know, I agree 100% with Anthony. We serve it at Blackbird, and we'll continue to serve it. And for me, the big issue that hasn't been brought into light is conventional way that chicken is raised, conventional way that pork is raised. If you've ever seen any of these facilities, believe me, the animal rights activists should be hooting and hollering about something that. Maybe there's some great lobbying power behind in our nation's capital that are equally and even more brutally raised and processed. So a small industry that raises foie gras, there's a right way and a wrong way to do it.
And in fact, the cruel method produces less good product.
Right. Those ducks come running for the feeding. I didn't see any, I don't see any pain in that process. And like I said, I think there's a lot more food that's raised
without question.
Just in horrible ways that people eat every day and don't complain about. So there's something fishy going
on.
Well,
veal as a type of food calls some moral issues into question, does it not?
Yeah, big time. The animals are tied down; they don't get to move. That seems a lot more brutal than ducks running around for the majority of their life and then being force-fed, and I don't see anything going on with that. We serve veal at Blackbird, but it's range veal. It's grass-fed. It's organic from Canada, and I believe in that product. It tastes great, and it's raised the right way, and I think you got to look at all your food. You got to look into it and see how it's raised and make a decision then.
I caught a hint in an interview that you gave to somebody, Tony, which I read just today, that you've got a certain amount of ambivalence or concern about carnivorous dining generally, particularly as somebody who prepares food, that you're not unaware of the suffering we impose upon animals.
I spent a lot of time traveling around the world, and you know, in when you get into rural Southeast Asia, you begin to understand where food comes from. You want fresh meat, you see something die in front of your eyes. You know, I think that you should understand the real cost of dinner. You owe it to a pig when you kill it, to not only to eat it and to eat as much of it as possible, to cook it as well as possible, to value it. Once you make the basic decision that you are willing to kill animals to eat them, I think it's only responsible and only good manners to cook them well and waste as little as possible.
And thank them.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I don't have moral problems knowing that a chicken died for my dinner.
Mm-hmm.
It is perhaps every chef has some moral obligation, I think, to at least see at one point in their lives the animals that they use, you know, die. They should know. If nothing else, they will, as Keller says, respect the ingredient, or be more likely to respect the ingredient. Waste is a terrible thing.
Here's the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I was wondering if I could get some recommendations for some cities in Italy. We'll be leaving next week, and we'll be in Florence, Rome, Naples, and possibly Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
Sicily, I can highly recommend the Palermo, the island of Pantelleria, Lampedusa. Sicily, you're going to have a great time. Be sure to eat the frittola in the street. It's basically...
we saw your program.
Oh, that was tonight. Yes,
that was tonight.
Yeah, follow my path there, because I ate well that whole time.
Thank you very much.
In Rome, go to the Monte Paperno, the greatest Jewish restaurant in Italy.
Oh, we wanted to do that.
And
could you please repeat that?
Monte Paperno, P-I-P-E-R-N-O.
Okay.
And be sure you eat the carciofi alla Giudea. The Jewish artichokes.
Wonderful.
All right.
And how about anything with Naples?
I don't know it.
You don't know it. And how about Florence?
Well, I was there when I was 17.
Oh.
I don't remember anything except that I drank too many Black Russians and passed out with my head in a bidet. So I'm in with no help.
Thank you very much.
We thank you, Matt.
Good night.
And one more call coming up on 591-7200. Good evening. Are you there?
Hi there, is it me?
Yes, ma'am. Quickly, please.
Oh, quickly. Okay. Pavillon, is it closed or not in New York?
Closed many years ago. Yeah.
I am a home economist myself, and I've worked with many chefs, and sometimes including you, but I'm not going to include you here. What makes chefs so arrogant? like they run the whole world when they step into perhaps my world where we're there just to help.
Yeah. I don't know. I think some chefs are going to be like that. Others not, I hope. I mean, I like to think in those situations. Generally, when I'm in my kitchen and it's busy and I've got a lot of things going on, I'm arrogant, decisive, and even a little rude. Outside of my comfort zone in the kitchen, I'm actually, you know, I like to think I'm, you know, pretty much of a wuss.
You're forgiven.
I'm easy. I'll work with anyone.
Thank you, ma'am, for the call.
You're welcome.
And we are just about out of time. We've got a minute or two left. Let's talk just a little bit more about what you do at Blackbird Paul. I've not been there, though I think I will now want to come very soon.
Great restaurant.
Contemporary American food, a lot of local and seasonal ingredients. Menu changes just about every week, focusing on what is in season. And we love to cook and we love to serve people. We have a great wine list and a great staff. And we've had a lot of fun there for almost 8 years.
And most of the people who work for you are tattooed.
Most of the people that work for me are tattooed.
We were talking about that again. You both disclosed to me that young cooks are somehow going in for a lot of food tattooing.
That's a worldwide phenomenon. Everywhere I go, whether
what do you
it's
make
Australia.
Of it?
We work hard. We feel different. Chefs and cooks feel different than normal people. Their hours are different.
Uh-huh.
They work. It's a very physical job. Their hours set them apart from normal society and kind of push them a little to the margins. And yet, you know, good kitchens are very tremendously high unit pride, and you're celebrating that difference by, you know, marking yourself with serious frightening outward appearance.
So it's we few, we precious few, we illustrated few.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think it's that same kind of mentality. Henry V, you know, rallying the troops.
Fascinating. Our guests have been, indeed, Anthony Bourdain and Paul Kahan.